So I don't know how much that wonderful introduction is going to cost me. I'll find out later on. What I'd like to do is talk to you a little bit about the history that we've gone through as we've evolved this discipline of environmental health risk assessment, and a little bit about where we're going. I just want to show this picture. It's Parliament Hill. It's two blocks from my office in downtown Ottawa, because some of the things I'm going to talk about today are uniquely Canadian. So I want to talk about the evolution of risk assessment in two parts. First, on the population health side, and then on the more traditional risk assessment side. And I'm going to put them together, because that's a unique contribution that I think we've made to the field. So if we go back to 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the medical model of health said, if you get sick, go to your doctor, the medical system will treat you and cure your disease. That's all there is to it. That's all that's involved in health. There was a book by Mark Lalonde called A New Perspective on the Health of Canadians in 1974. Just a little short thing, 74 pages, and it said, well, no, your health depends on biology, immune function, depends on the environment within which you live, air, food, water, soil, the built environment, and it depends on lifestyle. So this might seem pretty simple in 2011, but this was pretty groundbreaking in 1974. And another thing that the note said is they all interact to affect population health status. This is the foundation, the underpinnings of the population health movement. You can go through the next 30 years and make this more complicated, looking at additional determinants. This spaghetti diagram, I think, is probably too complicated, but it makes the point that there are many things that affect the health of populations. In my graduate course, we walk through these and other contributions over a 30-year period in great detail, and that's the short 2-minute version of the history of population health. Let's do the same thing for risk assessment. First book on risk assessment I'm aware of was William Rowe, 1976 or so, Anatomy of Risk, I think. So the genesis of risk science goes back. But the first major contribution is this well-known framework developed by the NRC in the 1983 Red Book. I wanted to show this. I know you've all seen it, because I'm going to change it a little bit before I'm done today. Another major contribution, the Presidential Commission. It looks different, but it's similar once you get down to the level of detail. And again, we go through the whole history of these and other frameworks. So now you've had the 2 minutes, 30-year history of the evolution of risk science. Now, what have we done? We've actually put the two together. When I came to the University of Ottawa, I started working in the Faculty of Medicine at the Institute of Population Health, and I got a new perspective. My risk science background seemed to fit nicely with this new population health approach, so we published a paper 4 years ago on an integrated framework for risk management and population health. And here it is. The key things are twofold. On the bottom, let's not just look at one risk factor, something in the environment that affects population health. Dioxin is a risk factor for liver cancer. Let's look at everything that affects that health outcome, the social environment, the occupational environment, genetic susceptibility. And the other novelty is looking at multiple interventions of a regulatory, economic, advisory, community-based, and technological. It's interesting that the first letter of each of those five words spells REACT. I didn't notice that. An orthopedic surgeon in Trinidad heard me present. By the time I had sat down, he'd got up. He talked about the REACT approach to risk assessment. So I'm in debt to Stephen Rappert. I'll come back to this later. Another thing that I do in my graduate course in risk science is, in the first lecture, I scare the students to death. I show them all the risks they face in their daily lives, and you don't have to look very far to discover that life is full of risks. By the time they get through 12 sessions, they say, yeah, we get it, we understand, we know how to separate the big risks from the little risks. So that's sort of the first part of my historical overview. I want to turn now to something that's more recent, the NRC report 2007, Toxicity Testing in the 21st Century. I'm not going to go over the report in any depth. I'm just going to mention we have a little paradigm which really focuses on understanding toxicity pathways, all sorts of new scientific tools, computational toxicology, genomics, high-throughput in vitro screening assays, systems biology. Chris Portier will talk a little bit about some of these things later today. But you use all of these tools to identify perturbations of key toxicity pathways. And then the risk assessment challenge is to avoid those perturbations. The big challenge, the biggest challenge in implementation is understanding toxicity pathways, mapping toxicity pathways that operate within the human body, and then finding efficient ways of identifying pathway perturbations. So I'm surprised how much attention this has got. If we look at progress since 2007, June 2007, the report is released. In February of 2008, there's a paper in Science by Francis Collins and others that sort of says, this seems like a good idea. There's a, in 2008 as well, three federal agencies sign a memorandum of agreement saying, we're going to do this. FDA joins the TOPS 21 consortium a little bit later. 2009, EPA incorporates virtually everything in the 2007 NRC report into its strategic plan for toxicity of evaluating the toxicity of chemicals. There's an ad hoc grassroots human toxicology consortium that is trying to see what they can do to enhance, to move forward the toxicity pathway mapping exercise. We call it the Human Toxone Project. And this is also caught on internationally. There's work underway in Europe to coordinate new approaches to toxicity testing, and I can tell you the same is true in Canada, in China, and other countries around the world. Just huge support for this since 2007. So if I turn to another major contribution, Wei Shui already mentioned the NextGen initiative that EPA is undertaking, and that's trying to do roughly for risk assessment what toxicity testing in the 21st century did for toxicology. How should we be doing risk assessment in the 21st century? So at the moment, the vision is built on three pillars. One is, how can we use the ideas from toxicity testing in the 21st century, new types of toxicology data for next-gen risk assessment? And I want to, this is a paper from the Annual Review of Public Health that we just published earlier this year, and I want to show you one chart from that, and this is, you may not recognize it, but here's the 1983 Red Book paradigm that I showed you earlier. And what you've got here are the four steps in risk assessment: a hazard ID using computational toxicology, genomics, and other new biological techniques, dose response assessment, again using new technologies, exposure science, put all this together into risk characterization, coming up with the human exposure guideline. The point of this is that we can use all of the new scientific tools and technology to do risk assessment using the same four-step paradigm that we're all very used to. So the process is the same, but the science is going to differ substantially. Cornerstone number two is the population health approach to risk assessment, which I already showed you, and I'll just promote my own work shamelessly by showing you the same slide twice in the same presentation. But I'm also going to embarrass our chairperson a little bit, because Wei Shui published a paper last year which basically, and you will tell the group you did not read my 2007 paper before you wrote this, Wei Shui.
I didn't even know that.
So this is basically the same thing. It's the population health approach to risk assessment. It looks a little different, but if you go through and look at the elements, I think Wei Shui and I are telling you this is something we want to look at for the future. Third cornerstone is new methodologies, and we can look to science and decisions for a number of methodologies. One of the main contributions of that report is designing the risk assessment to answer the risk management question up front. So a lot of emphasis in designing analysis on the basis of what you need to know. But we can look elsewhere. We have a paper, Solomon Sand, Chris Fortier, and myself, which is a very focused contribution, but it shows that there are activities, new methodologies being developed by a number of different groups. And the idea here is that for a point of departure, rather than following the dose response curve down to a benchmark dose of 5 or 10% excess risk level, and then going from there either with uncertainty factors or some form of extrapolation approach, why don't we follow the dose response curve down to the point where the signal and the uncertainty around that signal is roughly equal to the background biological noise? Basically, we're saying we're at the limits of the observable response range, and that becomes our point of departure. So we've evaluated this approach with bioassay data and are currently running through a detailed evaluation with in vitro data to see how it might work in practice. So those are the three cornerstones of NextGen. I think we sort of have some idea how they're going to fit together, but the final framework is still to be elaborated. I want to go into another topic, exposure science in the 21st century. I think there's an NRC committee with that name. I don't think they've reported, so I can't tell you what they're going to say. But I can tell you what I'm going to say about exposure science in the 21st century. This is a paper by Edwards and Preston, which talks about assessing exposures to populations, but then looking at what are essentially toxicity pathways and perturbations of those pathways, and trying to find indicators of exposure that would reflect such perturbations. So this notion of moving towards avoiding perturbations of toxicity pathways and measuring exposures in that realm is already starting to catch on. That leads us naturally to biomarkers. We're seeing more effort in Canada, the U.S., and elsewhere to actually measure biological tissues for the presence of environmental contaminants. My students have actually done theses on both the NHANES and CHMS data. But there's a nice focused application of this work that you may or may not be aware of. This is some work that Sean Hayes has led in developing exposure guidelines, not on the basis of external exposure levels, but on the basis of what he calls biomonitoring equivalents, which are essentially biomarkers of exposure, serum concentrations, if you like. So you can go back and forth between serum concentrations and external exposures using pharmacokinetic models. I won't show you all the details. It's in this long paper. But already, biomonitoring equivalents have been established for a large, relatively large number of chemicals. So we're already starting to see this being done in practice for real. So I think just about the last topic I want to mention is that as we start shifting towards more pathway-based data, EPA has already been looking at prototype applications of how we might use high-throughput screening data to conduct actual risk assessments. And there's a paper by Richard Judson, David Dix, and others at EPA where they go through how to do it, and they actually do a couple of prototype examples. BPA, the first line, gives you an RFD if we just did a traditional 100-fold safety factor applied to a rat reproductive NOAEL. But then if you look at a series of high-throughput screening assays and go through the analysis that they mentioned, that they recommend, you end up with something that's kind of in the same ballpark. Human exposure is much lower than either reference dose. So we're starting to see some of these new technologies, in this case HTS data, being used for practical risk assessment. So I hope I'm keeping to my time. And I have one slide left, which is where is the future, in my view. So 4 points. TT21C, toxicity testing in the 21st century, really provides a blueprint, which people seem to have warmed up to, for reorienting toxicology towards pathway perturbations, identification of those perturbations, and prevention of those perturbations for risk assessment purposes. This will probably engender a concomitant shift in exposure assessment methodologies, and the few slides I showed you today are really showing that we can actually focus on measures of exposure that do correspond to pathway perturbations. The emergence of risk assessment methodologies, science and decisions, I think is a major contribution, but other methodologies I think will follow to adapt to this kind of data. And the population health approach that you've heard me talk about, that Wei Shui has promoted separately, I think might give us a broader suite of options for thinking about how we manage risks to the health of the population. So if you look at those four, none of it is what we're doing now. It's just, somebody said, I think you said at the outset, Wei Shui, we're at a pivot point, and I think we're at a pivot point in terms of risk assessment methodology, toxicological data, exposure assessment, and broadening our horizons with this population health approach. Thank you.